Hello, and welcome to I Am Dad Podcast with your fatherhood authority, Kenneth Braswell. 30 minutes of wisdom, information, resources, and nugget on your fatherhood journey. Or maybe you're just curious and want to hear some real talk about fatherhood, family, and the minds of men. Well, guess what? We got you too. Sit back, grab your pad and pen, and maybe even bring a little something to sip on. Enjoy 30 straight minutes of fatherhood, family, and fun with the Fatherhood Authority, Kenneth Braswell.
Welcome to I Am Dad Podcast. I'm your host, Kenneth Braswell. Thank you for joining us once again on a Sunday morning or whenever you happen to be listening to us. We appreciate each and every one of you. Thank you for your comments. Thank you for your engagement. Thank you for the recommendations of people to interview. I don't know if you guys know, but we are like, I have 3 months of podcast in the can right now. And so typically when I'm interviewing, unless it's something that's really, really hot, it probably, and you won't see it for another couple of months before it hits out there. But that's just how popular the show has gotten. And so, but with each conversation, you know, it is a timeless conversation. It's evergreen. So it's not tied to an event or anything like that. So it's always relevant, no matter when it comes out. And there's so many dynamic people around the country doing this work that I'm always excited about the person I'm talking to and the work that we are talking about. So, but today's insightful episode of I Am Dad, we're joined by Shanine Moore, whose formidable insights into the child support system are sparking crucial conversations. As a PhD student at Hamline University and a pivotal figure at the Minnesota Department of Human Services, Shanine brings to the table a blend of personal experience and professional acumen. Her research delves into the racial implications of Minnesota's child support program, seeking to understand how policies affect families on a systematic level. Seeking to understand how policies affect families and advocating for policy reform and greater empathy in the mechanisms that shape the lives of countless families. So let's get ready for a profound discussion that challenges us to rethink the support systems that bind our communities. Let's welcome Shanine to the conversation that promises to be enlightening as well as transformative. How you doing?
So good afternoon. I'm glad to be here. I am doing well. Just coming off of a research convening in Atlanta, and it was phenomenal. So I come back with a lot of ideas and things to move this work forward.
So I am sitting there and I'm reading this article that you wrote, and I'm, yes. Before we get to that, though, because I'm so excited about getting into that conversation, we need to start here. I'm Shanine. With our podcast, we start with this very simple question, and it gives people insight as to who I'm talking to, and it allows people to either find themselves in you or of you. And that question is, tell us your daddy story.
Oh, wow. Yes. So my daddy story, my parents were young parents. My parents were married. Mom had me at the age of 17 and my father was 18. And they married briefly when I was the age of 3, and then they divorced when I was 7. Me and my father have a complicated relationship, I will say. And, you know, a big part of that complication, I feel, has to do with he was a good provider, but that emotional connection that daughters, in particular Black daughters, need with fathers, that was the difficult part of our relationship. And so we have a complicated relationship.
Point, I want to introduce you to Dr. David Miller. He's on my staff. He's actually doing a webinar shortly about men's grief. But he literally, it's been a month now, maybe 2 months, got his doctor's degree at Morgan State University, and his dissertation was on Black fathers and daughters. And so it's an area, I have 4 daughters. Mm-hmm. And so I know what it means from both sides. And him and I have been having these conversations about the nuances, particularly fatherhood, but more specifically around Black fathers and Black daughters. There's this really That's a whole nother book I can write.
Ooh,
I could literally write a whole book about my relationships with my daughters. Very different. And, you know, I think sometimes, you know, when I think about sons is a whole nother conversation, right? And so that's a whole nother conversation. But with daughters, it's kind of, that's not where we're going. But good Lord, you just struck something in me about daddies, black dads and daughters. I'm going to have to bring you and Dr. David back on at the same time so we can have that conversation and get people around that.
Yeah.
So listen, the reason I brought him up and the reason I brought up his dissertation around black daughters is because I've known David for over like 25 years, and I know what kind of person he is. And when he told me what his dissertation was going to be on, I was like, yeah, you didn't even have to tell me you was going there. I knew you was going there. When you began to start thinking about the subject matter of your dissertation, what led you into like saying, you know what, this is where we're going deeper?
Yeah. So for me, having lived the personal experience of child support. So I have two children. They are adults now. But at that particular time, having to navigate that system, as complicated as it was, right? So that I never thought I would land in child support, but I was always someone that could advocate for people and for myself. And so having done that work in the past, and then coming into the system, working in it, being a director, 10 years in, I just knew from the families that I had experienced, families that would come and tell me their stories, in particular black and brown families, I knew there was an opportunity here to think broadly and differently of how we do the work, how we serve families, how we need to change policy, how institutional racism impacts families. And we have to say that because in child support, we often have this narrative that, oh, well, we're just, we've got two parents and we're just exchanging a financial transaction between these parents. We cannot have, these experiences around racism and things like, say, TANF or, some of these other documented programs. And I'm like, absolutely, that's not true. And so the more that I read, the more that I understood the foundation in which the program was developed, that led me to understand that we have to talk about the systemic impact, in particular for African-American families, that this program is having.
You know, I love what you said about, the whole notion of when you're talking to people about child support, it's always the pushback that we get. Why do you want to racialize everything? Mm-hmm. It's like, are you kidding me right now? It's like, you want me to ignore like something that is really impacting one body of people in this country and has been for so long because you don't want to deal with your conscience, right? Or you want to, why can't we work with everybody? How come we just got to work with black people? We can apply that to a whole lot of other different things, right? And so if we want to go there, problem is you never want to go there. And when it comes to talking about this stuff, it's really important for us to do this. The other thing is when you talked about, like, you speak from your lived experience, and that's what I want to talk about, like the importance of being stimulated to do something because it impacted you. When I first started working in the fatherhood space and started my organization in New York and became the director of the New York State Fatherhood Initiative, when I came into the agency, OTDA, my program was within workforce development. And when David Hansel came in, he called me to his office and said, Kenny, I'm moving you to child support. And I'm like, nah, that can't happen, dude. I can't go back into the hood and tell my homies that, I work for child. That can't happen. And he was adamant about it. And then he said, you know what? He said, I'm not going to force you. He says, but I'm just going to tell you why I'm thinking this way. And he says, I think out of all the people I've ever met, that you have the best chance to walk into that office and change the culture on how they think about fathers. This is not only about the program. This is about helping change our culture so that we can at least understand and have some empathy for the fathers that we've been so geared up to use enforcement mechanisms to get there. When you think about your lived experience moving into child support, were there ever any triggers in child support that reminded you of something that stimulated you to get into child support in the first place, and you had to keep reliving that, and then using that trigger to a strength?
Oh, let me think. So I was fortunate that, well, no, I won't say that. My first case was pretty smooth and clear. I mean, we had our complications when it's time to modify. That's when the disagreements would come into play. My second case, it was a whole thing where, you know, we had to battle every instance, like, oh, he's not coming to court, and, you know, he's not voluntarily wanting to pay. And like, so I would say triggers for me, and I am very empathetic to both sides. So I think I might be a unique factor in child support, because a lot of folks are like, well, why are you so open and willing to help support dads, right? So I think triggers for me are just knowing when you've got situations and you know, especially for Black men, you know they have this desire and willingness to do the right thing. And these assumptions that come into play oftentimes, well, he should stop having all these kids, and, you know, maybe he shouldn't buy the newest pair of J's, or, you know, like all these assumptions about why Black men in particular might not have the ability to pay child support. So those became triggers. And thinking about the Black family in totality, right? Like, there are a lot of things from a systemic perspective that create these difficult relationships between Black mothers and Black fathers. And I try to tell my staff and people when I talk about this is that Black folks don't talk about child support in the same way many times that other people talk about it, right? And it can be a confrontational thing. And we have to understand the historical aspects of the program and why people think that way. And for Black families in particular, you know, it could have been, say, for instance, you and I, you know, child support 1974, my dad did not pay child support back then. But say if he had, and I'm hearing these stories from my mother about, well, your dad didn't pay child support, or he didn't do that. So you've got that piece. Now I'm having children, right? And, you know, and so that continuation of that cycle of trauma and understanding how sometimes these systems can pit Black families, mothers and fathers, against one another, and understanding how that happens. And so that was always something like, that was always a trigger for me in understanding and wanting people to understand, like, this concept around child support, number one, was never meant for Black families. So that's in the literature. But understanding now that we're here, how we continue to perpetuate that separation and harm by creating these enforcement, you know, these enforcement mechanisms and all of the things that keep Black families from being able to co-partner and co-manage that financial relationship at the betterment of their children.
Yeah, you know, the thing that I always talk about when it comes to this conversation around fatherhood, child support, family, marriage, relationships, all of these things, the thing and the element that makes it so difficult is that we're talking about human emotion. Like, that's at the core of all of this. You can put as much logic as you want around this, right? You can you could put as much science as you want around this. Human emotion will still break it, right? And unless you can harness that or help people harness that, the system is never going to work. And when I talk about that element of human emotion, people will say, well, then what's the driver of the human emotion? The driver of the human emotion is the most precious possession that a human can produce, have, and have responsibility over, and that's a child. Like, you can't regulate human emotion when it comes to a child.
Absolutely.
And so it's very, so if you don't deal with people and you don't treat people like people, whether you're talking about mothers or fathers, there is no regulation that's going to harness how they function within that system, right? Because when a father decides, I always say this to our father, Shanine. I was like, listen, dude, at the end of the day, you can't hate her more than you love your children.
Yeah.
Right? Loving your children has to be absolutely number one. And I know it is, but check your actions, because your actions don't show that. Your actions are showing me that you're more committed to hating her right now than you are loving your children.
Yes.
If I can get them to flip that switch, then everything else moves. When you began eating into your dissertation, doing research and finding out more and having these epiphany moments, like, what kinds of things that did you come across that you was like, oh shoot, I ain't know this?
So look, while we're sitting here on the couch, so I've read a few hundreds of pages, and there was a researcher here in Minnesota that I had never heard of. And as I'm digging through older dissertations, I found this dissertation. And I don't know if you can see this book.
American Child. Okay. Yeah.
And it's called Analyzing the Development of the American Child Support System. And it's a study in social policy development by Dr. Ruth Gilly Kruger. And Dr. Kruger, I've never heard of her. Now, I've been in Minnesota working in child support for 10 years. Never heard Dr. Kruger's name come up in any conversations. But she was a pioneer. And she did her dissertation research on the establishment of PERORA. And so for listeners, PERORA is the bill that you will often hear about when you think about welfare reform back in 96 under President Clinton. And PERORA really put the mechanisms in place for some of the things that we now see around enforcement measures. And, you know, so think about driver's license suspension. Think about contempt when you don't go to court or pay your child support. When you think about passport, pulling people's passports and credit bureau reporting, like all of those things come under play when you think about PERORA. And then the connection to TANF, right? So we're moving away from AFDC, we're moving into TANF. So Dr. Kruger analyzed, she did like a fellow type of relationship with Congress and some folks, and she did her full dissertation on the establishment of PERORA. And so I'm reading. So a lot of this book, or her dissertation, talks about in the early days of how they got to the resolution of why do we need to make this punitive? And there's pieces in here where it talks about Black families. And so the more that I read, I'm like, wait a minute. So this was not for the betterment of everybody. We get to this point in our history from a social policy standpoint, and we say, okay, we're going to do these changes in these programs, but if we do them at the quote-unquote betterment of everyone, then we're going to put these mechanisms in place for cost welfare recovery purposes, and we know what that language is talking about, to make sure we get all of our money back, that we're going to start using language like deadbeat dad and all of those, because that's, we know what that language, right, that coded language is about. and really pinpoint in that point in time when we start to see a lot of harm that was created for Black and brown families. So reading that kind of literature, I'm like, oh, the bulbs are like, oh my. Like listening to some of the, you know, listening and reading some of the congressional testimony around Perora, I'm like, whoa. So it's very coded racial narratives and things about Black and brown women and dads.
Yeah, and that's, that you know, really, and that's in line with history, right?
Yes. So when I talk to my child support peers, and I'll have to send you this. So as a part of my research, I found this document. So I've been in the child welfare space in the last year, and I wrote this article in that space around the impact, like say child welfare. And at that particular time, I was doing something for Juneteenth and how those understandings around community and all of that, what impact that has for Black families. And so I saw this visual where they broke down child welfare from the history of slavery to current day and the social policy and historical context, right? And it's mapped out. And when I saw that, I was like, oh yeah. So I said, I could probably do that for child support. And so I did. And slavery is very much, you know, from that historical context, like we were in the business, they were in the business of separating Black families from the onset. Then we have all this historical policy, all of these phases in our history, and then we get to, and we have to understand this, child support is a program that was meant for white women. It was never meant for anyone else. And once everyone else had the opportunity after the Civil Rights Act had the opportunity to come on in, that's when we saw a lot of these punitive measures put into place. So AFDC policy, you know, going to people's homes and making sure there's no men there. And like all of those things came into play when Black and brown folks came into these systems. And so continuing that narrative into the establishment of child support as a formal program. And then you have, you know, Perora and some of the other things that have come into play that has from a policy, matching that policy to the historical context of what's happening it's a big deal. And so when I talk about it from that perspective with my colleagues, they're like, okay, I can see that. And so we continually have these conversations. But the thing that I also need for them to understand is that if we're moving and we're saying we're moving to a family-centered approach, that means we have to undo the harms and things that have happened in policy, like things that we have put into law, like things around Perora, right? These enforcement remedies, like driver's license suspension and contempt, putting people in jail, that is not at the benefit for families. It's not serving families. And we got to do something different in order to really stand on serving a whole family.
Yeah, but you talking about hard questions.
Hard questions.
I'm talking like hard questions.
Yes.
Which is why you get into these meetings, you know, around the country. I'm in them all the time. And these conversations are so surface. They're so, and we're regurgitating the same information over and over and over and over. That's one of my biggest frustrations with research right now, is that there's nothing new. It's like Lee Jeans and Pumas. Like they was here before, right? What are we talking about? Let's get to some new stuff. Let's tell me something I don't know.
Yes.
Or reveal something that was a reality that we need to know, right? And so when we talk about the Pew Research in 2013 about the engagement of Black men in the lives of their children, and then we come to find out that research is now saying that Black fathers are the most engaged fathers of any other cohort of fathers in this country. We knew that.
Yes.
But it didn't become true until somebody else said it.
Yes.
Like, we are in the midst of our communities. I've heard someone say, someone's like, you know, daddy's an absent. I'm like, I don't know where you live, because everywhere I turn, there they are.
Yes.
Yeah. They just don't get recognized. But they're there in all of their dysfunction, right? Because we don't dismiss that either. Yes. We don't dismiss that there are folks out there that aren't doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. But that is a small population that drives the vast majority of the societal content around fathers, right? And so there's some new research that's, new numbers are coming out of this 2020 census, particularly the 2020 community, I forgot, there were surveys that they do. So it's kind of fairly new information that's coming out that 96% of all children born in this country live with either their biological or adoptive mom.
Yeah.
70% of all children born in this country live with either their adoptive father or their biological father. So this conversation that we're having is in this 30% space.
Yeah.
And residence doesn't equal involvement.
No.
Right? So when you take away involvement, we're talking about a small amount of people who might can be described as fathers who are not engaged, but then you have to then disaggregate why they're not engaged, right? Yes. So if there's unemployment, not working, mental health issues, all those things, incarceration, or you know, military, all those things that separate them. Now we're talking about a real small number. And it's like, if we can just get that conversation down to that point to say that these people that you imagine that's been painted that you're talking about don't exist, but there's a population of fathers out there who look different, who have different expectations for their children, who have different aspirations for their relationships, in addition to a large number of moms who will say, I want him involved in the lives of their children, and this stuff that you're talking about really isn't that important, right? At the end of the day, if the dude just came three times a week and never gave me a check, I'd be good.
That's it. As someone who experienced that, that was it. I'm like, I didn't need a check. If you would have just engaged in that way, I would have been good. So yeah, absolutely.
Right. But the punitive nature of how we have been built and bred is that if we don't have resources and finances, we have no worth.
Yes.
And that's the last way I want to show up in front of any woman.
Yes.
Particularly a woman who has had my child, or a woman that I'm married to or in relationship. I never want to come to the table with no value. It's just
Absolutely.
Not going to happen, no matter how much I love you, how much I want to be with you, how many kids I got, and more importantly, how many letters child support sends me to say
Absolutely.
Blah, blah, blah. If I don't have any value, I'm not showing up at the table. And yeah, like Chris said, lock me up. I'll go to jail. You know, I'm not going, because now there's the emotional presence is back involved, right?
Yes.
What is the complication, though, when it comes to really thinking about policy that you found in your dissertation that could at least be the starting point for us to begin a journey that gets us there?
Ooh, there's quite a bit. I would say, you know, in the child support space, so, for example, in Minnesota, we are state-supervised county administrators. So let's start with that. Federalism is a real phenomena where you have the federal law, and in child support, the Office of Child Support Service, they set certain federal regulations, and then we have to adhere to those. Where some flexibility will come in, though, is, you know, by state, you can determine how you implement those federal regulations as long as you do them. So I'm going to give you an example. So for a driver's license suspension, I am fortunate to be in a state where, and I've pressed the envelope, I'll say, where we know through our data that Black, Hispanic, American Indian fathers are more likely than not to have a suspended driver's license. We can go into our data and prove that. So a few years back, I had someone on my team that said, Shanine, this is an issue from a policy perspective. We really want to dig into this and change this policy. And so, of course, there were some that have that traditional connection to the program, like, well, we can't do that because it's federal regulations. And I'm like, no, we probably can. So let's look into it. So of course, I would say over the last 5 years, you know, when the pandemic happened, we were able to relax and waive certain enforcement measures, and driver's license was one of them. And I had a lot of people mad at me about that. Oh, why are you doing that? That's the only way we can get people to pay. And I wouldn't change my mind on that. And so we ended up doing a pilot with 12 counties because we received a procedural justice grant. Didn't have any funding tied to it, but we got some technical assistance from OCSS and Mathematica and a few other folks. And so we did a procedural justice project with 12 counties here in Minnesota from across geographic, so urban, rural. And my one condition of folks that wanted to be a part of this pilot was we understand the subjectivity of driver's license suspension, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
so there's opportunities there, or some people would get it, some didn't get it, some got more chances than others. And when I talked about it, I said, and when we're talking about subjectivity, this is what I mean. I need people to understand their implicit and explicit bias around things like driver's license suspension. So we made the agreement with every county that any staff participating in the pilot would have to do intercultural development inventory, or an IDI. And we have qualified administrators on my team. So they did some training and cultural competency work around understanding. And lo and behold, people were like, yeah, I could see I have some bias. I do, maybe I'm a little bit more harsh with certain people. So we ran the pilot for, I think, 6 to 8 months, and we had an evaluation, and all of this is on a website afterwards. I can send it to you. But our first evaluation showed, guess what? There is some implicit bias when dealing with white fathers or parents. There was less, you know, they were given more opportunity to correct or not even receive that suspended driver's license, where if you were a person of color or English was your second language, you were not maybe getting that second phone call or being reached out to in the same way. And so we're doing some additional evaluation currently, but that's just one example. So from a policy standpoint, we then were able to introduce legislation last session. We are changing our driver's license criteria. So then we won't, so we've got like a set of criteria of how and when your driver's license will be suspended in the state of Minnesota. So there are other states that are doing very similar practices, but that's just one example of how you can change, even though you've got these federal mandates and regulations that you have to adhere to, but from a state perspective, you can make the decision to do some things different that will benefit people in a positive way.
The one thing, because I'm not in the child support space as deeply anymore, and I'm not sure what the culture is as it relates to this, and that is it often, in the past, it has seemed to me, and to a certain extent does still, that performance measures are counter to doing the things that you're talking about.
Yes, and so they are.
If, They still are, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you have a strong desire to right the ship and that you do want to provide mechanisms for parents to be more engaged in those kinds of things, but the performance measure saying, well, you got to meet these child support collections every, or you don't get the bonuses, you don't get more money that's going to fund your discretionary programs and blah, blah, blah. And if you have a person in the seat that's looking at it from a financial perspective, and not from a service perspective, they're going to lean more towards what you're saying, which is, nah, we ain't doing that.
Yeah. So for us, I'm fortunately one that's not leaning more to the financial. And we don't, so this is one thing, we don't keep our incentives at the state level. I hand those all out to counties based on performance. However, how I talk about it is, and I think people are starting to grasp this concept. If we work on better serving families and participants and fathers and mothers, wouldn't our performance, you know, conceptually, won't your performance improve? And then if your performance improves, won't your incentive dollars increase? And people are like, but
that's logic. That's logic,
right?
Though. Yeah.
It's logic.
Yeah.
So it's understanding the customer service piece of it. If you can really get at the heart, and when I talk about it, sometimes people are like, well, I'm not a social worker. I'm not asking you to be a social worker, but you do work in health and human services. I'm just asking people to have some sense of empathy, understanding. And I also will often say, think about it, if it were your son or your daughter experiencing these things, how would you want them to be treated? And people can relate to that in many instances. But it's good customer service will lead to better outcomes. We just got the performance. Did we do an annual performance scale with all the states? I think I'm number 5 for collections on current. So, having that mental thought around serving people first and leading to better performance, there's something to that.
So I'm a dad, and I don't really know the intricacies of all the stuff you just said, right? I know it because I'm close, so I'm listening to you talking. I'm like, oh, that makes sense, that makes sense, that makes sense. But I'm a dad on the outside looking in, and I'm staring into the face of the judge, not into the face of Shanine Moore, right? And I'm calling my child support office, and they pick up the phone and they say, hello, child support services. In my mind as a dad, I'm like, help me understand the service part, because I don't really feel the service part. How are you providing a service to me? I don't get that. How do you tackle that?
So I'll say a couple of things around advocacy and the courts and working with county attorneys and those things. Some of the things I've been very intentional about are having conversations. So we have a good working relationship with our court administration here in Minnesota. So we meet with them on a monthly basis. We have conversations around equity and barriers and understanding of fathers and all of those things. So I'm fortunate to have those good working relationships with court administration. I also have taken it a step further. So the article that I shared with you, Hennepin County is my largest county here in the state of Minnesota. Folks over at Hennepin got wind of my article and said, Shanine, would you come and talk to our Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee about your research? I said, absolutely, I'll come. And so we had some dialogue conversation, and they said, this is phenomenal. We want you to come back and do it for all of our county attorneys within our child support group. And so I came back and I did it. And then they said, this is wonderful. We want to open this up to all of our county attorneys here in Hennepin County. We want to open it to all county attorneys within Ramsey County, which is our second largest county in the state. And then they also wanted to invite other city attorneys, and I think in the city of St. Paul and maybe Minneapolis. And I said, absolutely. So I'm going to do that in April. But I talk about the history, some of the conversation we're having today, and what that means as a as an attorney, when you have families that present themselves in front of you with these barriers, understanding that people are coming, they're afraid. Historically, the criminal justice system has not served Black families in a meaningful way. So understanding that aspect of this. And so when I talk about it, people are like, this is like amazing. And why haven't we had these conversations before? So to me, that's a part of the customer service aspect, because I need the judicial and the legal aspect of the program to understand the families that we're serving. And in order to make that situation easier for fathers when they go in front of that judge, if Shanin is doing a little bit of the back work on the other side, when those parents present themselves in court, hopefully that situation, and they remember those conversations and dialogues that we're having about barriers and understanding, will represent themselves when those families are in court. The other part around customer service for me is we have, at the state office, we have a help desk that is available to anyone. So if you're a parent, if you just have a general question, if you are a county worker, you can call and ask any question that you have about your case, about the work that we're doing. And so my teams are very much versed around understanding impact, around equity, around understanding, around, you know, being able to help connect people. You know, if we can't answer the question, we're helping them find the right person at the county that can help. And so I think that has helped a lot. And then just simply getting through to people that it only takes 5 minutes to, you know, caseloads are so big and we don't have time to call people. But if you took 5 minutes of your day to help understand a case that you've been working, that no matter how many notices you send out and threats, and they're still not responding to that, but you took 5 to 10 minutes to really talk to someone to understand their personal circumstances, and that helped resolve an issue, that customer service piece goes so much further, and it's going to save you time in the end, because you're not sending a million notices because you know so-and-so lost that job and we're going to help them modify their case, right?
Yeah, so it's
common sense.
Right. You know, my thing is, as I think about this and think about what you're saying, having, you know, stuck my toe and then my foot and then my whole body and this whole notion of DEI and then jumped out the water because it's like, you know, I don't like the way this feels. You know, for me, you know, change doesn't occur in the mechanics. And what I mean is that the policies and the things that we do, like, you can't change a father's or a mother's, for that matter's, notion of how they think about you and what you're trying to provide for them in the mechanics. Where change occurs is in the connections, right?
Yes.
And connections take place in the culture. And that is what I'm hearing you talk about. And that is what I believe is our biggest struggle, right? It is not the mechanics of child support. It is the culture of child support. And when we start talking about DEI, I used to say DEI is just another name for affirmative action, right? And then when I began to think about it a little more, I was like, all right, affirmative action was closing and eliminating disparities. Diversity is expanding to ensure that you have representation for everybody. Equity is triage, making sure those who are most in need get the most help. Those who get the least, have the least in need, get the least help. But it is relative to their needs, right?
Yes.
And then inclusion is providing a space where everybody's voice and everybody's needs can be heard. So when you think about DEI and affirmative action, because it's almost like we're adding letters to this thing. It often feels like to me that when you're sitting in front of an audience in Minnesota, in rural Minnesota, talking about DEI, that you're really trying to train people to code switch. Because when they go home, that's not part of something that they have to consider, do, and may not even be a part of their culture. How do you get DEI to become a part of their life culture and not just their job culture?
Yes. Ooh, this is a good one. So we are doing a couple of things. So I helped back in 2021, NCIA, which is the National Child Support, it was an enforcement association. It's now the National Child Support Engagement Association. Myself and Aaron Frisch, who is the Michigan director, we co-chaired the policy forum that year. And Aaron and I, and we should maybe do a podcast, me and Aaron together one day. But Aaron and I are kind of the disruptors in many of these spaces. And we said that year, you know, that was right after George Floyd's murder, which had a huge impact on me and Minnesota. And we decided that year we were not going to do a traditional policy forum. We were going to focus the entire forum on diversity, equity, inclusion, and impact on the child support program. And people were like, oh, and that was about, we were still under that old federal administration. And so people were like, well, maybe some people won't get to come because you guys changed the format. We're like, that's okay. We're still going forward. And so we did that. And that was probably one of the highest attended forums. And people really appreciated the conversation. And so from that perspective, we really got the conversation going at that federal level, because me and Aaron have been doing this work in our states for quite some time. So at a state level, I continued the work. We came back and some of my local folks here, directors were like, Shanine, I would love if we could do a forum like that at a statewide level. And I said, we can, but it's gonna take some time. We need to build some power and structures around a collaboration, and we could do it, but it's gonna take a little time. I said, but in the meantime, we need to collectively work on some equity and engagement strategy. And so that following year, we took the whole year and we decided we were going to establish an equity committee of 34 members across the entire state that would represent you know, various avenues of counties and state and tribal partners. We're going to get community in there soon. But what we did was we established a charter and a way to do this work. And now I have a statewide equity committee from every corner of the state, which 10 years ago, that would have never happened. And people are really stepping into the space. So we have a lot of times guest speakers. So if you ever want to come, I'd be welcome to have you. But we have guest speakers. We have collectively taken the IDI. So we're doing some cultural competency work. Right now, we're reading a book together called Whiteness in Plain View, The Exclusion, All Racial Exclusion in Minnesota, by an author known as Chad Montree. So Dr. Montree is not Minnesotan, but he came here during the pandemic and did some research about racial exclusion in Minnesota, because we have some of the worst racial disparities here. And so he sets a historical foundation of how that came to be. So I say all that to say is that we're doing, collectively doing all of these things together to give people the tools, both personally and professionally, to be able to think about this work, how it's impacting people. Minnesota, we are set to, I think, over the next 15 to 20 years, I believe, I've read some research recently, that every corner of the state, whether you are metro or rural, will be impacted, and people of color will be expanded across the entire state. So I often get the question or comment, well, right now that doesn't impact me because I don't have people that look like that out here in my community. Well, you have tribal, you have tribes, we have 11 tribes in the state of Minnesota. So you do have it. It's just whether you're looking for it. So
well, it's kind of one of those things that I kind of chuckled a little bit when I saw the your dissertation. And I was like, man, there ain't no black people in Minnesota. It's like,
we are.
And I know that's not true, but that's when you think about where we are, it's like that's the probably one of the last states, but it's up there.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to where we are. So it's so interesting.
Getting people to understand that. Yes, you may not think it, but it's there. We are everywhere. And thinking about how to, if you're not ready, you got to get ready because it's that is not going to change. And even I can see it. So I'm not Minnesotan by birth. I've lived here for 25 years. I'm Midwest, right? I came from Iowa. I went to college in Illinois, and then I came over here to Minnesota. But even just the 25 years, I have seen the increase in the diversity. I think here in the state, we have more multiracial children and diverse children than we have older folks. So there's gonna come a point that those children are going to outpace, and I think it has already shifted, if I'm not mistaken, that's gonna shift, and those children are going to be the future. And so we got to address that and be willing to talk about that and do things to ensure their futures.
As a result of that shift, I wonder if this shift is going to occur, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about this and every other thing that could be researched in this world. There is always a gender gap in that space that is typically leans towards men and not women. But as a black man, whenever we're having those conversations, I'm like, don't lump me in with white men.
Yeah.
Like, your wage equity ain't got nothing to do with me. Right. And so we don't have that level of entrepreneurship company owner in this country to impact that. Have sympathy for it. And absolutely, there should be equity in wage. But if I start talking about it, don't blame it. It's very clear it's not me. Right. Mm-hmm. And I push on that always because of this particular thing. And if there's one area in this country where the disparity is the opposite, it's in service delivery. So there is a gender equity issue in service delivery that leans more towards women than it does towards men.
Yes.
And I wonder if that's a conversation that we have to begin to have when we start talking about reform, because at the end of the day, we're talking about parents, right? And if we're going to begin to start doing alphabet soup with all of our words and names, and we don't want to talk about mom and dad, now we want to talk about families, then if you're going to be talking about families, you better be talking about dads. And if you're talking about helping, supporting, and serving dads, then services for those dads should be at the level that allows them to be able to meet the expectations that we have for them. Is that a conversation that you think is worth having?
I think so, because as you probably know, Health and Human Service, it's predominantly women, and it's predominantly white women. And so I think that is a conversation that we need to have. You know, how are we going to retain and recruit and mentor and create pipelines for women, in particular men? We need more men. I would love to have more men of color in my teens, because that's important. Representation matters. And I think we do need to have that conversation on how we're going to change that dynamic.
Yeah, I was at a meeting on the Hill here in Georgia a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago, with the National Parents Union. And they were celebrating men, and more specifically, black teachers. And there was a whole conversation around the need to increase the number of black teachers around the country. But in the beginning, they did this kind of quick survey where they had everybody in the room raise their hands that had ever had a black teacher throughout Wow. their primary and secondary education. And it was so few people, it was ridiculous in the room. Yeah. Now, we in Atlanta.
Yes, so, that's what I was about to say.
Right. And there was a whole bunch of people that had never, younger people, different story. Mm-hmm. Like in Atlanta, they have multiple. When you go look at possibly maybe hip hop generation going back a little bit, particularly traditionalists and baby boomers, like who lived up. I grew up in New York. Never. And then when you look at social workers and you look at people who you are coming in contact with in hospitals and health facilities and those places, they tend not to have very many black men in there. The excuse used to always be there's no money in it.
Yeah.
And they found when talking to men that making a lot of money is important, but it is not the necessity. The necessity is to do something that is meaningful in their lives.
Right.
Right. And so we have never, and at least I go back in my career thinking about counselors and people who said to me that this is a path that you can consider. The only path that was given to me that I should consider was the military.
Isn't that something? Right?
Yeah. And so we really got to start thinking about, to your point, about where men's voices are, and more specifically, black men's and men of color's voices are in levels of government that impact policy,
yes,
right? Yeah. And impact culture in those things, that we got to do a better job at doing that. And I don't know where to start with that. I talk about it, and I mentioned, I mean, when we was at that thing, that I'm looking around the room, I'm like, where the dudes at?
Yeah.
I know we out there, like, they should be in this room. And many times when I go into those rooms and there are only a few voices, men of color, in the room, they're silent because they believe and feel like they can't say anything, because if they say something, they're going to get beat back.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And so, that's just one of the areas that I think is critical for us to do. Shanine, thank you so much for talking about this. There were so many different places we could have gone, and we're going to come back and dig into this a little more. But as we end and close this out, like, where do we go? Like, if we're going to have an impact on this, like, is it the policy? Because you mentioned policy, you also mentioned advocacy, and you also mentioned service. Is it an equal push, or is there one of them that should be pushed more than the other?
Yeah, you know, for me, in the perfect world, we could push on all the three, and that we would somewhere meet in the middle and change would happen. Realistically, I think policy and law and legislation is where we're going to see the biggest impact. And unfortunately, that can sometimes take the biggest amount of time and change and tenacity. So, for example, the driver's license suspension. Oh, and we just got rid of interest last session, or either last session or session before last in Minnesota. But guess how long it took us to do that?
I can imagine.
Over 15 years.
Yeah, I was going to say 10, 15. Okay.
Yeah, so it's policy change through legislation, and that takes the longest, but that's really the key to understanding and getting people's hearts and minds and thoughts and changing and transformation and innovation. That's going to be the way to do it.
Yeah, and that's another piece of work that has to be done too, particularly with not-for-profits and organizations of color because we just don't know how to advocate legislatively, right? And we've always been told, hey, if you got a 501c3, you can't lobby. It's not true. You can't spend all your money in lobbying, but you can and you are supposed to. It's part of what you do as a not-for-profit. You should be in the face of your representatives talking about the work that you're trying to do, looking for increased funding to allow you to scale and do more of that work. And there needs to be a national effort in particularly not-for-profits that are led by people of color to really understand that you can have a tremendous impact on how things move from a federal perspective and a legislative perspective if you just put a little effort in showing up you're trying to advocate for your very specific issues than opposed to following someone else when they're advocating for theirs just so that somebody else can see your face.
Yes.
Right. And that's a whole nother piece of work. But thank you so much. I appreciate you. This won't be the last time you be on. I'm going to bring you on. And I do got to bring Erin. I did talk to her one day and I was like, I got to get you on here. She's like, oh, call me whenever. And so I'll probably do her separately so I can get to know her. And then I'm going to bring both of y'all together so that we can have a real, real conversation. But I do think that these conversations around child support, I'm going to use the word struggle, but it's probably not. It is struggling a little bit, even from my hat of running the Responsible Fatherhood Clearinghouse. We struggle with how to have the child support conversation with fathers because those conversations are different. It's not the same conversations that we have in these kind of high level meetings. And fathers want to hear about child support in a specific way. Like they don't care about policies and all that stuff. They're trying to figure out, how do I navigate this system so that it doesn't become a burden on me so that I can sustain what I need to for my children and myself? Yes. And that the nature of my relationship is not a curse and held against me because I can't pay child support. Right. And so, but that's the conversation that we got to have on both sides and we got to figure out. But I think that there's a deeper understanding where I was talking about you earlier as to where we should be having what conversations about what we're trying to accomplish.
Yes.
And create solutions.
Yes. For. And I will end with this thought. So when you were talking and we were talking earlier about research and the limited amount of research, one of the reasons I decided to focus on the Black family from the TANF and child support perspective was there isn't any research that I could find where we collectively talk about the impact of mothers who are receiving TANF. And as a result of those mothers receiving TANF, have to cooperate with child support, which then means they're bringing that Black father into that equation, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I have not. And I've searched and I searched and I searched. And I'm like, so where are we in this conversation? Number one. Number two, if we know that these disparities and disproportionalities exist, why isn't there research to better understand the impact? And number three, if we need to change policy and have examples with data to inform those policy changes, where is it? And so the more that I talk to people about the research, the more that I talked about the project, people are like, absolutely, you got to do it. You got to do it. You got to do it. Mm-hmm. And so I am looking forward to the project, to moving it forward, to talk about Black families in this space, to have a collective understanding of these two programs when you bring Black families together and the level of impact that it's going to have. So more to come on that. And that's another conversation.
So
but research
I wrote
is
down,
so important.
I'm going to plant this in your head now. Think about this. I wrote down the title of our next podcast.
Okay.
And I have to think about who I bring into the space that allows us to really hit this thing and hit it hard.
Okay.
The title is The Black Entanglement of TANF and Child Support.
Ooh, yes.
They are in an entanglement.
We are there. Yes, yeah, absolutely. It is an entanglement.
Right. So, Shanae, thank you so much. I appreciate you. Man, you bring such a great spirit to this conversation. And you got my wheels turning about a couple of different things. I'm sure we're going to do some great stuff together. And we're going to influence a lot of people to do the same.
All right.
To all of my I Am Dad podcast listeners, thank you for joining us for another inspiring and thoughtful and heartfelt conversation. You know how I like to leave you. Always be kind to others as you're kind to yourself, or you might find yourself by yourself. Always shoot high for your goals, because even if you miss, you'll be amongst the stars.
Thank you so much for taking the time to spend with us. You've been listening to I Am Dad Podcast. We hope that you have been informed, encouraged you to think, or even inspired your heart for the love of dads. The conversation does not end here. Come back and join us next week. Same time, same place. Or you can continue the dialogue on our I Am Dad Facebook page. We also invite you to listen to past episodes, learn more about us, and keep up with special activities by visiting IamDadPodcast.com. That's IamDadPodcast.com. Until next time, I leave you with this reminder of manhood from 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 11. When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. Because of this reminder, I will always understand that I am dad, period.